The Merchant of Venice is the second of Shakespeare's plays to open in the 2007 Globe season entitled Renaissance and Revolution. It joins Othello and follows a revival of Howard Brenton's successful In Extremis, a play about Eloise and Abelard, which was premiered here last year. Later, Love's Labour's Lost and two new plays, Jack Shepherd's Holding Fire about Chartism and Eric Schlosser's We the People about the American Constitution, will take the stage in Rep. But today, joining me, Heather Neal at the Globe, to talk about to Theatre Voice, is Rebecca Gatwood, the director of The Merchant of Venice. Well, Rebecca, I think this play was first done at the theatre in Shoreditch in the 1590s, but presumably the Globe is fairly similar. Do you find it's helpful to be doing this play in a similar sort of environment to the one for which it was written?
Absolutely. I mean, it definitely demands that it releases some extraordinary things about the play when you do it in an Elizabethan playhouse. There are all sorts of kind of directions that Shakespeare's written into his text, which suddenly make sense to you when you are doing it in an Elizabethan playhouse. For example, there are various scenes that take place at night, and suddenly you realise why the language is so, and the imagery is talking about night and the stars and the moon, because of course the Elizabethan audience would be watching it during the day. So you have to create that through the language and through how the actors are behaving on the stage. There are other moments where you might have somebody on a balcony. And you then have a little, they then disappear to make an entrance down onto the stage, and there tends
this
to be...
This is true of Portia, is it,
Well, Portia in her casket scenes, I think that there is sort of evidence in the text to suggest that she would be watching the casket scenes from the balcony, in a sense like a princess who's being fought for, you know, in sort of a battle below, you know, and then there's a beautiful moment where the scroll tells Bassanio, turn to where your lady is and claim her with a loving kiss, and there's a sense there that she's moved from the balcony down onto the stage because he's now won her, and there's a sort of magical moment where you can sort of imagine that the doors open and you see her come onto the stage. There's also another moment when Jessica is on the balcony and she throws a casket of money down, and then she makes a re-entrance down below out of the doors as she's leaving Shylock's house. And there's about seven or eight lines in between her exit upstairs and her re-entrance, and that's pretty much just about enough time for the actor to get, you know, from upstairs to downstairs. So there's little moments like that where you can see he's written it in the, he's, you know, the way that he's written it gives you clues to the staging, and that releases something rather special when you're actually having to do it in a in Elizabethan playhouse. Whereas actually, there are some moments in the play which are quite incongruous if you're staging it in a Prosarch theatre. You know, Portia, for example, saying, look how he goes when he goes to the caskets, when Bassanio goes to the caskets. And that makes sense if she's upstairs and he's come downstairs, but it wouldn't necessarily make sense on a sort of flatter stage, if you see what I mean. You can make it work, but it there's something very magic about actually being able to play it in the space it was written for. Yeah.
But you are adapting the theatre, aren't you, in a way that probably, as far as we know, Shakespeare's contemporaries wouldn't have. So you're making two worlds, I think.
Yes, we're sort of, you know, we have two locations in the play, and we wanted to...
That's Venice and
Belmont, that's right. So we wanted to make some distinction between those two environments. And in order to do that, we've got a little Venetian bridge, which sort of comes from the yard up onto the stage, so people can make an entrance over a little bridge. And we're sort of, and we've also got a sort of Venetian landing platform, so that we wanted to play with the idea that the audience are the waters of Venice, constantly sort of moving and shifting, the audience in the yard. And I think that hopefully will be very exciting. And we won't use those areas so much. I mean, we might break the rule once, But we won't use those areas in Belmont.
Now, this play was written as a comedy, although I think there's some discussion as to whether Shakespeare's comic lead, Will Kemp, or his tragic lead, Richard Burbage, played Shylock. The Globe tends to draw out any comedy there is. Do you find this liberating or a problem in that modern audiences tend to find this play difficult because of the anti-Semitism, possibly, particularly because of recent history?
Yes, I have found it very, very liberating because my view of the play has always been that this is a comedy. I think essentially it's a play about a very irresponsible, spendthrift young man and a very, very wealthy heiress who get together.
This is Bassanio and Portia.
Bassanio and Portia. And for me, you know, setting the play in Venice, Shakespeare's chosen to set it in the sort of centre of trade and commerce of his day, and it's a very, very rich, wealthy, glamorous place, which on the one hand I think he's sort of idolising and celebrating, but on the other hand he's being rather critical of. But I think there's great fun to be had in the character of Bassanio, and the sort of arrogance of those young people, that very wealthy, privileged young people that the play tends to be about, and the relationship, therefore, between this very, very wealthy heiress and her spendthrift husband, and he needs to be tamed, and he needs to learn that if he's going to effectively marry into so much money with his back history, which is of somebody who cannot hold on to money, then he needs to he has to be sort of tamed by Portia, which is what happens throughout the play. For me, I think it is a comedy, and I think it's quite a broad comedy, and I think Shylock is a comic villain. Shakespeare lived in a world which was anti-Semitic. I think we have a tendency not to want to think of our greatest playwright as being anti-Semitic. I think it's not like Marlowe's The Jew of Malta, which is an extraordinary kind of stereotype, really nasty stereotype. Because it's Shakespeare, he's much more... he's much more perceptive, and he looks at characters in a very rounded way. So you get quite a lot of humanity in the character of Shylock, but you also, of course, get a sort of villainous tray,
Do you think that Shylock was a surprise to the Elizabethan audience? Do you think that Shakespeare subverted the Marlowian villain enough to give them a bit of a shock?
Well, I think yes, he may well have done. I think it's hard for us to know precisely, but I'm sure that that, for example, it could well have been that during the Shylock speech, "Hath not a Jew eyes," for example, that the Elizabethan audience may well have heckled. But I think potentially by the end of the play, when Shylock is so beaten, to be given lines like, "I am not well," and the way that he leaves that courtroom scene, I think Shakespeare's appealing to our humanity there, to feel, even though we may, as an audience, feel relief that Antonio has got off and his life has been saved, the way that it happens, Portia gets quite carried away. And Antonio is the most liberal. We have Portia, she sort of initiates his punishment, and then the Duke joins in and is more liberal than Portia is, and then Antonio, in a way that I feel very strongly, he forgives him. He goes through the play sort of learning the meaning of Christianity, and he sort of saves Shylock at the end.
Despite the forced conversion, which is difficult for modern audiences to watch.
It is very difficult, but Shakespeare was living in a time when forced conversions were happening. It's problematic. And so on the one hand, I think we have to feel ambivalent about it. I think we have to sort of see it from Antonio's point of view, that it's a generous act and an act of love that he asks.
Well, he actually thinks he's saving Shylock's soul. That's what he's doing.
He has to think that. Yeah. But of course, for Shylock, it means the destruction of his identity and his culture. It's a huge thing. So it's of course very he's almost dead at the end of the play, in a sense, because everything has been stripped away from him. But on the other hand, you know, should he choose to embrace Christianity, he could effectively be reunited with his family, you know. But it's much harder for Jewish men to convert to Christianity than it was for women at that time. So the feeling is probably that he will be ostracized from his Jewish community and never quite fit into a Christian world either.
And he's already an outsider, isn't
yes,
he? And I think you've said that you're interested, or you think Shakespeare was interested, in the outsider character, that to begin with, Antonio too is an outsider if he is in love with Bassanio and losing him.
That's right. I mean, I think Shakespeare is interested in these sort of isolated characters. And there are a number of them in the play, actually. You know, you've got Antonio, of course, who is older than the young men that he knocks around with, and has this sort of secret love and a melancholy because he's losing his love. You've got Shylock, of course, who is culturally an outsider in Venice, and therefore there are all sorts of restrictions on the way he lives and the job that he can do and the way he can earn his living. We see him battling effectively against a dominant culture, which is the Christian culture. But then you've also got other characters like Gratiano, who, although it appears that he's at the centre of the group of young men, actually I think that he's such a party animal, this character, but I think there's a deep melancholy in him right at the centre of his character, and that's why he also feels he's losing Bassanio and why he's desperate to go with him to Belmont and find a wife and change his life. So I think there are a number of outsiders in the play, and I think it is something that fascinates Shakespeare.
So we end up with Portia and Bassanio together, Gratiano and Nerissa together, and Jessica and Lorenzo together. But all these couplings begin as sort of transactions, don't they, and money is very important in all their relationships, rather uncomfortably, rather disgustingly almost to begin with.
Yes, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's interesting that the language of Bassanio and Portia's, you know, commitment to each other is all couched in monetary terms. The imagery is very financial. You know, when Jessica steals from her father's house, she basically sort of, well, she robs Shylock of huge amounts of money. There's a casket of jewels and money that she drops from the balcony, but there's also, you know, she talks about gilding herself with some more ducats. And I mean, certainly for me, the way that I've staged that is that, you know, Lorenzo opens the casket, sees how much money is in there, and then says, "Beshrew me, I love her heartily," you know, so that all of these relationships are absolutely bound up with money. And, you know, that is a fascination for Shakespeare in this play, and it probably comes from, you know, partly the way that society was structured with, you know, women and dowries, and, you know, marriage was always sort of bound up with a kind of financial security and a fortune and for the future. But also perhaps that he, you know, is in the centre of a very profitable business running his playhouse. And so, you know, there's an interest in money, and Venice would have been seen as the sort of epitome of you know, those financial dealings and the beginnings of capitalism, you know, is starting to happen. So it's
even in that beautiful speech in Such a Night, Lorenzo and Jessica's speech, when they're in the peace of Belmont and everything seems so romantic, all the images they use are of tragic couples or infidelity, aren't they?
That's right, and I think Shakespeare's sort of hinting perhaps at the idea that, you know, Jessica, again, she's an outsider. She's joined this, you know, she's become a Christian and she's joined this group. But actually, you know, for her, her preoccupation in that scene is worrying about what's happening in Venice to her father. And, you know, the kind of crisis of everyone going off to save Antonio reflects on her, because it's her father who is waging the vendetta. And there is a sense that these these two, they've been very, very spontaneous in their getting together. And there's a sense that, you know, in that language that potentially, you know, they can't... I mean, Lorenzo talks about her. He says, when he receives a letter from her, he says, I'm fairer... what does he say? He says, so he talks about the paper being very white, and he couches her as fairer than the paper. So he's again sort of trying to make her, he's trying to sort of rid her of her culture and her ethnicity somehow, and make her into a white Christian. And they've both sort of, they're denying their past in order to be together. And there's a sense that Shakespeare's therefore saying, you know, they're going to have to address this at some point down the line, and this relationship may not last forever.
Yes. Belmont is a sort of unreal fairy tale place anyway, isn't it? And that's where the casket scenes happen. But then Portia goes on that amazing journey personally, where she goes to save Antonio. She's been under the thumb of her father rather as Jessica has, hasn't she? How does she deal with that? Jessica runs away. But
yes, I mean, Portia's in a sense, is, you know, she's frustrated at the beginning of the play with this idea of the caskets, but I think she has to take comfort from Nerissa, who says to her that her father was always a wise man, and that her father has put in place the caskets in order to protect her from making a bad choice. So she, you know, she sort of has...
Again, for money reasons.
Yes, for money reasons, because it's so important that she finds a good man. And, of course, the man that she's in love with, and the man that Bassanio is sort of the perfect choice, because he's a Venetian, so she won't have to move and go anywhere else to Morocco or Aragon. She can stay local, she can stay in control, and as long as she can master Bassanio, then she's going to be all right. And so from the point where they get together, and Bassanio indeed does, I think, start to fall in love with her, but not until he opens the casket and sees her picture. And ironically, because it's Bassanio, he sort of falls in love with her portrait before he falls in love with her, you know. But they sort of get, they you know, they get together then, and then she has to. She realises that she's married a man who in a way, there's three of them in the relationship, because the attachment, the bond to Antonio is so strong that she has to...
She realises this,
and she has to go to Venice. She has
from the way he speaks about Antonio.
Well, and from the impact of Antonio's letter. Mm. She realises that she has to send her husband back to Venice. She has to allow that to happen. And then she also, because she's just married him, but they haven't consummated their marriage, she has to go to Venice herself, which is the city of sin, after all. Money and sin and, you know, having a good time. She has to get to Venice, and she has to find out what this relationship is all about. She can't just let Antonio die and not get involved, because then she'd have a grieving husband on her hands. So she has to get involved with that, but she also has to see the strength of this relationship. And the fifth act is crucially important. People often say, why is that fifth act there, you know?
This is when they return to Belmont and the ring, subplot, yes.
I mean, it's crucially important because she has got to get Antonio to step out of their marriage. And she, when she gives the ring back to Bassanio, the ring that he has given away...
thinking it's to someone else, well, when she is in disguise.
Yeah, it's her in disguise. When she gives it back, she makes Antonio witness their marriage. And Antonio knows what that means. And he knows that at that moment, he is becoming responsible for the success of Bassanio and Portia's marriage, which means he has to back off. Mm. And that's crucially important. The real wedding doesn't really take place until the fifth act, when also Bassanio has learnt his lesson and he is finally able to say, I promise I will never more break faith with thee.
So you're more optimistic about this marriage than the Lorenzo and Jessica?
Yes, absolutely, because I think they've worked through their issues through the play, you know. And
Bassanio's grown up somewhat.
And he's grown up. He you know, at the start of the play, he's a child. He's a spoilt child.
Yes, money's going to come from somewhere. He just assumes that.
I mean, he's probably... I don't know whether he's an heir who spent his fortune, or whether he was a second son who didn't inherit and has a sort of an allowance which isn't enough for his for his lifestyle, but he's definitely somebody who throughout the play learns to take responsibility for his actions, and grows up and becomes a man.
Well, Portia too experiences what must be some sort of liberation when she goes to Venice dressed as a man and can take control in a way which is obvious to everybody. But does she know how she's going to save Antonio at the beginning, or is she thinking on her feet?
I think she's absolutely thinking on her feet. I think she has this sort of arrogance, which all of those young people do, to think that she can walk into the courtroom and sort the whole thing out. That extraordinary confidence to be able to do that. But of course she arrives and she doesn't even know the difference between, she says, which is the Jew and which is Antonio. Well, that would be so obvious to anybody that I think everybody in the courtroom at that point thinks, oh my God, what is, you know, this is not the person we were expecting. But she then sort of launches into her Quality of Mercy speech, appealing to Shylock's better nature, and he of course has already had a conversation with the Duke where the Duke has done the same thing and he's refused, so that doesn't work. And it's from that point on which I think she must go in thinking that she can win Shylock over with her idea, a Christian idea of mercy,
and it's a very beautiful speech, and she knows that,
you know, she's kind of crafted it and she's, you know, she's decided that this must work. But of course she's talking in Christian terms and he's Jewish, so it's a totally different, you know, she hasn't anticipated quite where he's going to be coming from. So she then from that point on is sort of in a rather panicked way thinking on her feet, and it's not until right at the last moment when she imagines the knife going in that she realizes that she's found the loophole in the bond, which is blood.
Yes.
No, that he can't shed any blood, he can have flesh but no blood. And what's ironic about the scene is that actually it's Shylock who points out to her the wording of the bond earlier in the scene, and there's a sort of moment where, you know, I don't think the penny drops there, but I think she then, in the moment of him crossing the stage to cut Antonio's flesh, that's the point when she looks again at the bond and she sees her answer in the wording of it. So it's, yeah, I mean, you know, it's tense.
Yes. Well, there's cruelty in most of the characters, isn't there? Quite a lot of them, anyway, have some cruelty, including the clown, Lancelot Gobbo, who's perhaps one of the hardest roles for us to respond to now. Shakespeare's clowns are often a bit difficult for us, aren't they? Because he's quite cruel to his own father, for instance.
Yes, he is cruel to his own father because he tells his father that his son is dead. I mean, I happen to think that's quite a tough relationship between the two of them, because I think that I sort of ask myself why the old Gobbo comes on the stage at all. And I think it's, you know, he comes and he says, how do you and your master agree? And I think in a sense, there's a sense that he's coming to talk to Shylock in order to try and get a pay rise, because I think Lancelot Gobbo is sending money back to his father. So again, it's another there must be a kind of mercantile relationship going on there. And I mean, the way that we've chosen to play it is that when Lancelot Gobbo tells him that his son is dead, the father is angry because it means the end of his income. Absolutely. So that, you know, these relationships are tough, all of them, because money is involved all the time in this play.
It's another case where you have an old and a young person in tension as well.
That's right. Yes, I mean they're another sort of parent-child relationship, and there are lots of those in the play, and they're all sort of kicking against each other and sort of showing us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all the characters are extraordinarily rounded. You know, that I think we sort of have to fall in love with Bassanio as a spendthrift kind of. You know, he's amusing and he's fashionable and he's sexy and he's sort of you know, he's exciting and he's a party animal and that's wonderful and he's got great wit. You know, but then we then also, you know, see Gratiano in the court scene as, you know, who's part of all that. We also see him as being completely completely shocking and vicious to Shylock. So we see sort of, you know, two sides to everybody, just as we as human beings have have these different
We do tend to be we're pulled, as I think you've said, in different directions by Shakespeare. We make up our mind and then we have to change it.
Absolutely. But, I think it's very easy to, I mean, I think this play, you know, has been very problematic, and I've seen productions of it where the comedy has been lost because we've sort of, I think, overly concerned with the Jewish question. And I'm not to say that I'm negating it, but if you sort of, the tendency, I think, when you become too involved with that issue is that the play loses its freshness and its comic potential. Yeah. And I think we often think more about issues when we're able to laugh. And we're also able, if it's funny, we're able to also be more tragic. Well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it'll fit very well on the Globe stage. We're looking forward to seeing it. Thank you very much, Rebecca Gatwood.